everybody. Welcome to episode 10 of the 2QB Experience. This is the Tyrod, Ty God, Ty Goat, Taylor Experience. Welcome. And we have some special guests for you this episode. The first is the other co-founder of 2QBs.com, Sal Stefanile. How you doing, Sal?
Doing good, Greg. Glad to be back on the pod with you guys.
It's good to have you back. What's been going on?
Not a whole lot. Just been pumping out a ton of content over at 2QBs, getting ready for the Scott Fish Bowl, which happens to be a great topic today with our upcoming guest.
Yeah, we have the one and only Scott Fish, at ScottFish24 on Twitter, senior writer and developer at Dynasty League Football. Scott, welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me, guys.
It's great to have you, and you know, Scott has created the Scott Fish Bowl, and that's what this episode is all about. We're just going to, you know, hammer it until, you know, the nail disappears into the log, or however I want to butcher that sort of analogy. Scott, do you want to start by telling us a little bit about what the Scott Fish Bowl is, just for the listeners who may not be familiar with it?
Sure. It's a 480-team pro-am. We have 360 analysts from around the fantasy community and 120 fans. Basically, it was first started to be like my old websites, Listener League or Website League, and we wanted to include a bunch of community members. And then it just turned into a community event, a way to connect and get to know maybe people you didn't know in the community. And it has grown into this massive beast onto itself.
Yeah, it's pretty exciting. Everyone on this pod right now is going to be participating as, you know, some of those 480 various players. It's crazy how big this thing is and how much of a buzz it creates in, you know, fantasy Twitter and all that stuff. I can't wait. This is my first year playing in it, and I've always been a big 2QB guy. And so the Superflex format really appeals to me. I'm very excited.
Yeah, and I'd say most people that play in this treat, and really you should generally, I think, but most people in this treat the Superflex just as a 2QB almost in this.
You know, one person I forgot to introduce when we started off the pod is my typical co-host, Josh Lake. How you doing, Josh?
Hey, buddy.
Well, welcome back. Sorry to, you know, put the kibosh on you there for a little while.
No, it's fun to listen to these guys talk.
You're off the leash.
It's good to be back.
If he hadn't introduced you, would have you just sat there quietly all episode?
I think I might have just gone to bed.
I mean, if I was in Josh's position, I would just like listen the whole time and not say anything.
See how long it takes Greg to introduce me.
It's within the realm of possibility that I would have forgotten too.
Say something near the end and confuse the listeners.
It's like, who the hell was that? Well, Josh, how are you doing, my friend?
I'm doing well, kind of adjusting to life back. I was out on a work trip for a couple of weeks and now catching up with football, with life, with family, and kind of trying to get my feet under me. So feels like we're hitting football season as well. Seems like there's a whole lot of news, a lot of leagues starting up. So it's a fun time of year.
Yeah. Are you ready for this Scott Fish Bowl action or what?
I am stoked. This is my third year in the league, and I've made playoffs, but not much more than that the last 2 years. So here's rooting for some more upside this year.
Yeah, actually, do you want to take a quick moment and talk about maybe your strategy from past years, what worked, what didn't work?
Sure. So one of the things that's relatively unique, I think, in Scott's league, many of your leagues, I think, Scott, but the giving points per carry, so that there's a quarter of a point per carry in the SFB. And so I've tended to go much heavier on running back than I would ordinarily and rushing quarterbacks. I had Cam Newton last year just because that extra quarter point per carry can actually end up meaning a significant chunk for the bell cow running backs. And so I've gone with a heavier running back crew both years, and it's done well. I've had good wins in the regular season, but it lacks kind of the upside that a heavy wide receiver team might.
Yeah, that makes sense to me.
Yeah, and it is really tough to, if you go too safe during the season, you might not have enough variance to make it through the playoffs. That's always such a tricky balance to cut in this league.
Scott, can you talk a little bit about the playoff format? Because I'm sure a lot of listeners are wondering, with 480 teams, how do you narrow that down to a single winner?
Okay, well, when you get to it's a 12-week season, which this year sucks because there's two teams on bye in week 13. Luckily, it's Tennessee and Cleveland. But the playoffs start week 13 a week early because of the amount of teams. And basically what happens is half of each conference, and a conference is 60 teams, 30 teams make the playoffs. And basically 50% is cut each week, and then we have a week 16 final that combines the conferences.
Yeah, so you can see how at the end you're not just competing against the folks in your own league, you're competing against a lot of other players who might even have the same, you know, NFL players on their team that you do. And to differentiate yourself in that sort of context, you have to have a little bit higher of a ceiling on your team, and that usually means incorporating some extra risk into your roster decisions. It's a super interesting format, and I've never played in a big league like this before, so I'm admittedly a little scared of, you know, botching that whole aspect of the strategy.
Yeah, it is interesting, but it's hard to, at least when you're in your draft, you don't feel like you're botching anything. I think that's one of the beauties of the design of the scoring system in this, is if you come away 10 rounds in and you have five tight ends, you can justify it. It's tight end premium. And if you have three quarterbacks by that time, hey, it's super flex. This is going to help me. If you have a bunch of running backs, you went running back heavy, you got the quarter point per carry. And if you go wide receiver heavy, I mean, they're wide receivers and it's 2016. So,
and you can start up to seven of them.
Yeah, exactly. So no matter what you do, you can justify what you've drafted. And I think that's what makes people like these drafts so much, is that you can look at your team after 10, 11 rounds and you're happy no matter what you've done.
I think go ahead, Josh.
Sorry, Greg, I cut you off. But Scott, the Superflex thing is obviously our baby, Superflex and 2QB, but it's relatively in the minority. So I don't know the answer to this. Was the SFB always back in its origin Superflex, or is that a change?
Wow. I know that it's been Superflex for the last 3 or 4 years. I can't remember if in 2010 or 2011, if it was Superflex or not. I honestly just can't remember. I could probably look while we're talking, but I know it's been that way for at least 3 or 4 years. We've had the points per carry for 3 years. We've had Superflex for 3 or 4 years. Tight end premium is actually new this year. I really wish I had done it last year, but I like to evolve the league a little bit. It keeps people on their toes, and it makes the, you know, us normal industry guys that play in a billion leagues, it makes us actually put some thought into it.
Well, yeah, that's evident by all the discussions on Twitter. Like, it's just, you haven't seen this much talk over one draft than you do with the Scott Fishbowl. It's kind of insane to see how many people are excited for it, talking all the different strategies and just getting ready for it.
And just the mock drafts. Yeah, this year has been crazy. How many dozens there have been?
Yeah, I never thought that ever be a thing. It wasn't even a thing last year with 360 teams. But this year, people want to prepare. And it's not just like, No, there are analysts that are, you know, well-known analysts and analysts that are highly respected, that they're like, I got to test this out. This is so unique. I've never done this. So you'd figure a lot of established people would probably just rest on their laurels and think, it's a fantasy draft. I know what I'm doing. I just pick the best players. But no, people are actually getting into testing out some strategies.
Yeah, that aspect of kind of designing a unique league is always something that's been fascinating to me. I love just the concept of fantasy league design. And you've talked about how you've evolved the settings over time. I'm curious as to what sort of lessons have you learned through that process about making a league, and about, I don't know, finding a league that you enjoy a lot?
Well, I've been playing since 92. I started in 92, and that was a dynasty league, and it was touchdown only. So I've really strived to evolve things in all my leagues. And I don't know. I guess maybe I have a problem with my league design, in that I get bored easily, and I want something new and challenging and exciting. And that's probably what has caused all this. If you look at any of my leagues, they're far different from normal stuff. And honestly, people just really enjoy that. I think people are craving a new kind of fantasy experience out there.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, that's the backbone of where 2QBs.com came from, is just this love of the two quarterback format and what we believe it adds to the fantasy experience as a whole. And the Scott Fishbowl is a perfect illustration of that, for sure.
You know, you mentioned like people getting bored of the traditional type of fantasy leagues, and now we're up to 480 participants now this year. I mean, did you ever think it would get this big, and like how many people are going to be in it next year? I can't remember who tweeted out like you had like 1,700 people already signed up for next year or some big number like that.
Oh, I honestly don't know what next year is going to be. We had 1,800 for this year. And so basically we had to turn away well over 1,000 people, 1,300 people, something like that. I never imagined it would get this big, ever imagined that. last year I started to get the hint. Two years ago, I had a waiting list of about 20 people, which I thought was amazing to actually have a waiting list. And it turned out some of them flaked, and I had to go around. And I believe Sal was one of the people I had. No, he definitely was. I had to pull in to try to fill a spot 2 years ago.
Yeah, that's been me the past 2 years. I've been kind of the ringer. This will be my first time drafting in like 3 years.
Yeah, so like that's good that we get to actually see a fully Sal created team.
I don't know if anybody wants to see that based on my mock draft.
Yeah, Sal's got some crazy ideas.
Yeah, well, like I was saying, 2 years ago I only had 20 people on the waiting list and pretty much no analysts, and that's why Sal got pulled in. And last year about the same. I think I had right around 100 on the waiting list and almost no analysts. This year I have well over 1,000 fans on the waiting list and probably, I don't know, 20, 30, 40 analysts. So I'm ready to go if someone drops out this year.
Do you think
that's
we would
insane.
Ever?
Yeah. 1,000 people on the wait list. That's awesome.
Do you think it'll ever get so big where we'll see like the Scott Fishbowl 480 times two, like pool A, pool B, and then the winner of each one goes up against each other? Because it sounds like you have enough people, but I don't know if you have enough time to manage two Scott Fish bowls.
That is exactly the thing. I was telling, having a conversation in real life with a couple of people that are in SFB. We met up at a cabin on the Minnesota River this last weekend, 4th of July weekend. And I said, it's too much. I can't do it. And he looked at me and said, you said that last year at 360. So we'll see if SFB 600 comes to be a thing. I like taking baby steps just to, I like being organized, and I guess shooting for the under so that when I hit it, I can know exactly where I don't want to just overdo it and then realize it's way too much. But at this point, I'm really, really probably just going to keep it at 480 for next year.
Maybe we could break it up into like the Scott Fishbowl is the NFL, and then Sal runs his Canadian Scott Fishbowl as well.
Oh, that'd be sweet.
The field will be a little bit different.
Well, we could also have like a live draft on the Minnesota-Ontario border. I'll just go home for the summer.
I think the Canadian one would have one-pointers, a bunch of one-pointers, right? Is that how that works?
Yeah, we have one-pointers.
You know, we did toy with that this year, and it's mostly my fault on the organization side and just getting busy. But we did toy with the idea of having a live SFB draft the night before SFB started, one that people could possibly watch in on or whatever. But it didn't end up happening. I think that is a fun idea for some point, though, would be nice.
Like a Facebook Live or a Periscope.
Oh, we were thinking live just regionally because there's so many people. There's probably 25 people in Minnesota in this thing. I wouldn't doubt Minnesota, Pittsburgh, or Pennsylvania. There seems to be some hotbeds for fantasy that have a lot of people.
Yeah, what is it about Minnesota that Is there anything? Is it just the cold drives you indoors in the football months, or why is that?
It's just so hard to root for the Vikings.
Yeah, I don't know. That could be it. I think that we had some early adopters to the fantasy lifestyle, the 2Vs and the Charchians and stuff, and they were on the radio here, you know, 20 plus years ago. So I think people got the itch. People my age got the itch hearing that on the radio. Maybe I don't know. I played before I started hearing them, but yeah, that could be part of it. I really don't know. Driving them indoors.
There's that spot in Grand Marais called the world's greatest donuts. That doesn't hurt.
Wow, that's an awesome deep dig. That I've actually been there. That's impressive. And okay. I will admit they are good donuts. I haven't tried every donut shop in the world to say that for sure they're the best, but I'm working my way.
Nice. So speaking of time, what is realistic? I don't even just speaking for myself. I was going to generalize it, but I don't have any concept of just how much effort goes into planning it. I would assume some of it you can carry over year to year, the rules, things like that. You don't have to spend long on, but what do the man hours look like to keep this thing up and running?
Well, I change the site every year, and that's just me being a web developer that likes just changing things up. And that takes a little bit every day for I just spend a little bit of time tinkering every day. I'd say the main thing is that starting in April, I start going at it probably an hour a day. Organizing the fans, making sure that they still exist and they still want to play. I have to make all the new logos for the banners. I have to make the MFL sites after. I have to make all the MFL sites. Make sure all the settings are exactly right. I don't know. I'd say I probably put in an hour. I would say a good hour every day or two from April up until now. And now it's just. It gets ridiculous because I'd say the majority of my time on working on this is replying to emails.
Wow.
Do you have anybody else helping you out on the back end, or is it just all you?
Nope, it's all me. I did email Ryan McDowell after the divisions were randomized. I have an algorithm that, you know, separates sites. It doesn't always work because if I put football guys with a space or without a space, so sometimes it doesn't always work. But after I got done with the divisions, I emailed Ryan McDowell to have him take a look, let me know if anything looked wonky. But other than that, yeah, I pretty much do everything.
Might be time to hire an intern for next season.
I know. People have recommended an intern, and people have also recommended a commissioner per conference. Which doesn't sound like a bad idea right about now.
All right, so we've kind of like, you know, talked through the back history with, you know, the Scott Fishbowl, how it came to be, how much you're involved in it. I imagine a lot of people listening to this podcast are trying to wonder, you know, what's the best strategy for this year. So do you have any personal strategies for this year's draft you'd care to share with the audience, or is that something you're keeping a secret?
I pretty much do the same thing every year. And I came in second in this league once. I have been in the conference finals. I have missed the playoffs. I have gone 1-11. So I think my strategy doesn't really have a clear-cut way to end the season. But I basically, every time I do this, I go running back early, even before the points per carry. I feel like there's just a billion wide receivers out there. So I like to go running back early, and I generally go one quarterback in the first four rounds and then another quarterback in the next probably four rounds, and then another quarterback in the next four rounds. And I realize that that's not what most people probably should do. Just based on the top scoring teams last year, you'll notice a lot of them had those Fitzpatrick and Kirk Cousins flyers. But I like to get three good quarterbacks in the first 12, 13 rounds. It's just something I feel more comfortable with, not having to worry about my quarterback for, you know, during the season.
Well, you talked about how you just added the tight end premium this year. Is that going to affect how you draft that position?
I think it would have last year, but this year there's just so many more tight ends that I feel a little bit more comfortable with. I mean, last year I feel like, you know, there were three or four at the top of that list, but now if I'm getting a Ladarius Green or a Kobe Fleener, or, I mean, you got Kelsey and Olsen, and even Julius Thomas might be a solid touchdown option. And then you got, of course, Gronk and Jordan Reed. I feel like there's so many of them that I'm not as worried about tight end as I might have been last year. So it's not really playing much of a factor for me.
Yeah, and based on the ADP that we have for the Scott Fishbowl, it seems the majority is kind of thinking that way too, just looking at it, comparing receivers and tight ends. By the time the top 24 receivers are off the board, there's only been two tight ends going on average, and that's just Gronk and Reed. So it kind of plays into the, you know, the way you just mentioned, there's so many, you know, viable tight ends available late.
Yeah, but I will say, going with a lot, I'm a guy who likes to get two solid ones generally. So I'm one of those guys. I'd rather take a ton of flyers on wide receivers, and I'd rather get my other three positions nice and fixed up, two decent running backs, a couple decent tight ends, a couple decent quarterbacks, and then just flyers all the way on wide receivers. There's something really comforting about having two or three really big tight ends tight end premium league. It almost makes you smile when you set your lineup every week.
Well, if you're getting that extra bonus just from the receptions, just those guys that get the big volume would definitely separate themselves over, you know, kind of the touchdown dependent tight ends that occupy those middle and lower tiers of the position. So I can see the value in that. That makes a lot of sense to me.
And though there was an article recently on two QBs from Scott Smith, who wrote like a top 10 tip strategy for the SFB, and just looking at the tight end position, and he said if we based it on last year's numbers and you combine tight ends and receivers, 8 of the top 24 finishes would have belonged to tight ends, and that Gronk, Delanie Walker, Jordan Reed, and Gary Barnage would have finished 7th, 8th, 9th, and 10th respectively in SFB 480 scoring. So it's kind of interesting to see that those like elite-ish tight ends would, you know, go up in scoring its tight end premium, which makes sense, but that their ADPs are still, you know, almost far below what those you see of the right receivers.
And Sal, I know you just had an SFB mock where you took, I think, 5 tight ends in 5 rounds. Maybe that's exaggerating it, but can you describe how that went?
Yeah, well, I was planning on going tight end times 5 to start off, but I just couldn't pull the trigger on Jordan Reed early. I did end up taking 5 tight ends with my first 12 picks, okay, which basically was like a quarterback tight end strategy and punting running back receiver other than getting LeSean McCoy early on. And it's basically what you expect. Like, your running backs and wide receiver depth is not going to be that great. It's not for the faint of heart. But if you're toying around with the tight end premium settings and looking at the stats Scott provided for the last year's SFB compared to this year's, if you're willing to take that risk and just going quarterback tight end early, you know, fill up that super flex spot and fill up the, because you can start up to 5 tight ends to get that tight end premium, it could be a way to establish yourself over the field, because long term you are thinking like, how are you going to beat 480 teams? So it's kind of a long term strategy, but you also have to focus more of like getting those boom bust players at running back and receiver, the guys that have a higher floor but might have have a high ceiling but might have a low floor, which it's not a strategy that has been too well received so far on Twitter that once I've shared it, because people are just like, why would you draft that many tight ends and just completely ignore your running backs and receivers, especially when you have that running back carry bonus?
Yeah, that is one thing I noticed about this draft that you did, Sal, is that the wide receivers you took are like the DeSean Jackson types, Torrey Smith, Mike Wallace, and I think that makes a lot of sense based upon that floor you're setting with the heavy tight end approach.
I would love to see you correctly pick what week those players are going to have good weeks.
Yeah, unfortunately, it's not a best ball league.
Yeah, I actually kind of love what you did in that league. I might be one of the rare ones, but. You did something that a lot of really well-performing teams in SFB did last year, which was have two decent quarterbacks and throw a couple darts that, you know, Geno Smith or Jared Goff, maybe one of them is this year's, you know, Fitzpatrick or Cousins or whatever. I don't know that I believe that much in that, but you know, that's interesting. That's okay. I like Cousins and Rodgers. And they do run they do get you those points per carry too. Both of those people. And tight ends, ridiculously strong. You're going to start five every week, probably.
Yeah, you bring up that running back premium, and that is something that I'm really interested in because, like you, Scott, I love to draft running backs earlier, even in spite of, you know, the recent insurgence of, you know, zero RB through the fantasy landscape. So I love this league because now I can take Todd Gurley in the first round or Le'Veon Bell or Adrian Peterson, and that feels correct to me if I want it to. I'm more interested in how that setting affects the quarterbacks. Like, now we can pretty much say definitively that Cam Newton and Russell Wilson should be the first quarterback selected, correct?
Yeah, I mean there's, what were there, only three quarterbacks that had 100 rushes last year, and those were two of them, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, Tyrod was the third.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, so that's an extra 25 points, which I realize that's only 2 to 3 points a week, but that could win games.
Yeah, and it can help out too when you add up the points at the end.
Yeah. Yep, definitely. Oh yeah, especially cuz this league I don't know if I mentioned, I don't think I mentioned, about half the teams get in on record and into the playoffs, and half the teams get in on points. So those that extra 25 will matter. I did want to make another comment about Sal's mock here. Even though your wide receivers and tight ends are a little on the weaker side because of what you did, I think I always feel like wide receivers and running backs are much easier to get on waivers in season.
Well, right, especially if there is a tight end premium. You know that all of the, you know, decent volume guys are going to get drafted, whereas in a normal, you know, 10 or 12 team league, that might not be the case.
Right, and with the five tight ends I did take, I feel pretty comfortable. Like, as long as they don't get injured, I'll be starting them every week. So it's one position I don't have to worry about on the waiver wire, which I'm not sure if a lot of people take into consideration the waiver wire in the Chicago Fish Bowl. But that's something where you have to pick up the guys you want like a week ahead, especially at the quarterback position. Because there's, in this one mock draft I did, I think how many quarterbacks were taken? Like, pretty much every viable quarterback is going to be taken during this draft, and anybody that pops up during the season is going to be immediately snatched up. So you have to be thinking of this like in a 1 week advance interval.
Yeah, Geno Smith was drafted in the 18th round as the QB 36.
Yeah, that was me. So yeah, Josh McCown was drafted in this one. 38 quarterbacks went in this mock I've been in. And the ADP shows us that there's 46 quarterbacks in the ADP data.
Yeah, and just the fact that it's a 22-round draft means that the waiver wire is going to be so thin in the first place that it's going to be highly competitive if a guy's on waivers when he, you know, kind of breaks out, that you are going to have to do what Sal talked about and sniff these guys out ahead of time. It's going to be a really challenging league. I can't wait.
You know, one thing I do with waivers in this league, I'm sure there are a lot of SFB players listening, so I probably shouldn't say this. I usually avoid week one because week one, there's no waivers after the draft until week one. And there's going to be a lot of quarterback decisions made. There's going to be a lot of, I'm sure there'll be injuries. There will be, you know, depth chart decisions made. That week one is just an absolute bloodbath. So there's so many people going all or nothing. I just kind of pass on it and save my money for people that actually start performing in season.
When people are just itching to do anything fantasy related earlier in the season, you get those itchy trigger fingers in week one and week two. And yeah, it can burn you sometimes where you might, like last year, you might have dropped to Kirk Cousins in a normal 2QB league based upon his performance, only to have him, you know, come back and be very, very good. I have one other point I want to get to, Scott. I know your time with us here is limited. And this is kind of just a general super flex question that I deal with a lot. And that's, when, if ever, is it correct to not use a quarterback at the Superflex spot? How often did you see that in the Scott Fish Bowl in years past? And do you think it's ever correct? Like, what situation, aside from just pure necessity, could you imagine yourself doing that?
Thanks, you took away my answer.
No, that's fine.
I was gonna say pure necessity. Well, I was gonna say something similar. I was gonna say it. The only way it would happen for me, the only way that I would concede to doing that would be with injuries and buys. But I suppose if you just hit on enough players that there might be tough enough matchups, if you have a quarterback that traditionally doesn't do well against tough matchups, I suppose it could happen. But in a league where half the teams get in on points, I'd just rather chase the sure points. Unless it's late in the season and you are on the bubble, maybe you want to go for the higher upside plays. I can see that happening.
And let me give you a reference point. I looked up what a bad quarterback was worth last year in points per game in these settings. And Nick Foles, who was just dreadful last year.
So bad.
In points per game, he outscored Amari Cooper, T.Y. Hilton, Ted Ginn, and Randall Cobb last year.
Woof.
So that, to me, says if you have someone that's starting under center, you probably are going to be playing him.
Yeah, wow. I did not realize that. Because I definitely haven't taken a look at exact. I crunched numbers before the season, but that is insane how much quarterbacks got bumped because I dropped PPR down.
Right. Wow. And the running backs, because of the points per carry, they were a little more reasonable. Like, it was Matt Jones and Ryan Matthews around him, so they seem like they might be a little bit more balanced with the quarterbacks. But yeah, the quarterbacks just seem to crush so many receivers.
I don't know. Even Matt Jones and Ryan Matthews probably would have been considered, you know, starters a lot of weeks last year. Whereas if you were starting Nick Foles outside of a bye week or an injury situation, like that, you couldn't have felt good about that necessarily. But I wonder how much of that has to do with the fact that, you know, the truly bad quarterbacks are often bad because they're not good passers. Maybe they have a bad, you know, team around them, a bad offensive line, and they could be picking up some extra points from those carries that they're making, just, you know, scrambling so they don't get sacked every time.
Yeah, nice. But yeah, that could be.
Imagine being the guy that had to choose between Nick Foles and Amari Cooper in the flex, going with Amari Cooper, and then see Nick Foles score more points that week.
Oh God, I would not want to live with myself on that. Wow.
It'd probably make you question whether you wanted to be in the Scott Fish Bowl the next year.
Yeah, it kind of makes me question if I need to tone down the scoring on QBs a little bit next year. Honestly,
it's only 4 point per touchdown pass, correct?
Correct.
Okay.
Here's another example. Sorry to cut you off. Teddy Bridgewater, who was much maligned last year, points per game, outscored Alshon Jeffrey, A.J. Green, Sammy Watkins, David Johnson, Larry Fitzgerald.
You're making me sick. Well, geez, that is insane. Scott, we really want to thank you for your time, and I hate to just kind of cut this short because I'm having a real good time talking about this stuff with you. But before we let you go, do you dare to predict a winner of all the different entries in this contest that you've set up?
Oh, man, I hate to. I hate to even try. I mean, my instinct is to go with like one of the guys that did really, really well last year, you know, like Kevin Cole or Eric Dickens or something, or John Paulson or Jeff Brubach did really well too, I remember. I think it's probably going to be one of those guys that didn't do a lot of mocks, didn't go overboard trying to overthink it, but also did, you know, do a little bit of work. But if I have to go with anyone, I think I'm probably going to win it. No, I'm just kidding.
Good answer.
You know what? Maybe I will just go with Kevin Cole, just because I felt bad last year that he got – he led basically wire to wire in points, and then he just got bounced from the playoffs. I don't remember how early, but I remember seeing that and just shaking my head and feeling bad. So I hope he gets to, you know, go a little farther this year.
All right, Kevin Cole, you've been jinxed.
Official jinx.
Scott, thank you again very much for coming on. Is there anything else you want to talk about before we let you go here and run off to another podcast?
No. I just want to thank you for guys for having me on the Tie Goat episode. I know you're going to get into that next year, but he did propel me in SFB last year. I got him in the 22nd round as the last quarterback in the draft, QB 38.
Wow, beautiful.
Yeah, so that was a nice grab.
All right, Scott. Well, thank you very much. We're going to keep this train rolling. We have some more to talk about here, but we're going to let you go. Thanks again. All right.
Thanks a lot, guys.
Thanks, Scott.
Yep.
All right. Well, that was awesome. Really excited to have had Scott Fish, the namesake of the SFB, on. If you want to find out more about the Scott Fish Bowl, you can check that out at scottfishbowl.com or just look up the hashtag SFB480 on Twitter. Speaking of hashtags, we've got a lot of hashtag content on the Scott Fish Bowl up at 2QBs.com. I want to talk a little bit about that. We touched on Sal's mock draft, but Sal, you also took a look at the ADP that was assembled by Robert Marino and TJ Hernandez. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So thanks basically to Rob and TJ. You can find Rob on Twitter at ChubChubMcGrub, which is two B's at the end. And TJ Hernandez is at TJ Hernandez. They were running a bunch of SFB 480 mocks, and they were kind enough to share the drafts with us so we can put it all together in the ADP chart, which you can find on our website. So basically, it kind of shows how most people have been treating the 101 pick, where it's either Antonio Brown or Le'Veon Bell as a first pick. But since this is a super flex league, which is basically two quarterback league, kind of want to look at the quarterback position. It's kind of, you know, in line with the 2QB redraft ADP we've seen this offseason, where Cam is the only quarterback in the first round. And then you see the likes of, you know, Aaron Rodgers, Russell Wilson going in the second round. Andrew Luck is in there. So it's kind of interesting just to take a look to see what positions and how many are going in each round. But also that it's a tight end premium league, so you have all these different scoring settings, which is going to make this ADP really interesting to see how people will utilize it in their actual SFB drafts, which, no, that's 480 teams compared to only 12 mocks for this ADP. But it still kind of gives you a sense of, you know, what round to, you know, target quarterback, what round target quarterback to, should you, you know, use an early pick on tight end or not. And we've seen tight end, there's only one early tight end, which is Gronk, which makes sense because everybody will, you know, automatically kind of go towards Gronk in the first or early second round. But it's the quarterback positions where you're kind of wondering, like, how many people are going to treat this super flex league as a super flex league or as a two quarterback league. And when you see only four quarterbacks going within the first 20 picks, it might give you an idea of where you might be able to take advantage of the mindset of the public, where they might kind of just be devaluing the position a little bit. So I think that's been kind of interesting when looking over the data.
Yeah, I was very surprised to see Russell Wilson all the way down at an ADP of 17.8, especially with that rushing 0.25 points per carry premium that there is across all positions.
And that one, I mean, it does surprise me because you think he, you know, could be in line as the QB2 behind Cam Newton. But Aaron Rodgers and Andrew Luck, who are going ahead of Russell Wilson, do have some rushing history with them.
So that's a good point.
It doesn't surprise me a whole lot, but I can see where you're getting at because of the points per carry bonus and that the fact that Russell Wilson was only one of three quarterbacks last year to rush for over 100 times.
So yeah, this ADP data is very cool, and it's definitely forward-looking. Now, Josh, you had a piece on the site that looked backwards at the Scott Fish Bowl. You looked at the best teams from last year. Do you want to discuss that a little bit?
Sure. If you're not looking backwards, what are you doing with yourself? I went back and did nothing predictive. I just purely said the top 10 finishers. So this is after the playoffs are over, just the top 10 teams. So there's a ton of luck involved in who these are. But I also thought it was interesting to see the teams that had a volatile, high enough upside team that they could finish in the top 10 out of 360. And so all I did was look for patterns and kind of see what was common, what was different. And just to keep it short, waiting on quarterback and waiting on tight end were both very common last year. I was surprised to see that even these very good teams did not stream quarterbacks well, that they had many, many weeks where they had a bench quarterback, someone that they sat, outscore someone they chose to start. And these are the best teams in the league. So I found that interesting. We've talked about streaming with Brian Malone on a past episode, and this kind of fits one of the ideas we talked about, that we are worse at playing matchups than we like to give ourselves credit for. We can still do it well, and I think there's still a lot of good reason to do it. But to think we can do it flawlessly is just disproven by all of the evidence, including this.
Yeah, the other thing I really like about your piece is that section where it talks about how these teams drafted in their first three rounds and just the wide variety of strategies you can take and still have a team that was competitive in this giant league. So check out the piece. Take a look at how many different ways you could potentially win through the draft. I think it's really awesome. The one thing that does seem to pop out more than anything else is the fact that running backs early definitely did matter. And that 0.25 per carry bonus definitely weighed heavily for most of these teams. Not all of them, but most of them. The last few posts I wanted to mention here were by Scott Smith, a guest writer at 2QBs, and he has just been churning out content for us, actually. He has one piece that's 10 tips for drafting in the SFB, and also a couple lists of over and undervalued players. We won't go super in-depth here, but make sure to check those out. And also check out a bunch of interviews that Zach Law put together for the site, talking to a bunch of people who are in the league, their general draft strategy, a little bit of, you know, non-fantasy interview type content. You can learn a lot about the people who are in this league and where they're coming from. It's really a diverse group. I mean, when you have 480 teams, it's bound to be diverse, but it's cool getting to know everybody in the league a little bit through those interviews. We want to thank Zach for putting those together. That was awesome.
And you didn't hear this from me, but if you look through the interviews and you find someone you're playing against in your league, they may or may not be giving away how they're drafting in this. So, you know, let's keep that in mind.
All right, so let's get to the GOAT. Let's get to the tie GOAT. Now, this is very appropriate for the Scott Fish episode because I've talked at least a lot about the 0.25 per carry bonus. And with that sort of scoring setting, boy, do I want a rushing quarterback. And as you guys mentioned earlier, Tyrod was one of the three players to have, what was it, over 100 carries?
Yeah, one of three, Cam, Russ, and Tyrod.
And we already know that rushing as a quarterback helps you build a nice stable floor. But in a format like this where it's not only building a floor, it's giving you upside, Tyrod has a lot of value. But before we talk any more about him, let's play the game. Let's play the QB finish game. This is where we predict where Tyrod will finish the season in terms of total points and average points or points per game at the end of the 2016 season. Sal, you're the guest, so you have to go first.
I'm going to go on the high end and say QB8. If you know, that's with the caveat that he plays a full 16 games. But even when he played only 14 last year, he was still QB8 in points per game. So I guess my prediction is just basically what he did last year.
And what do you think about total points? Do you think he'll be more like equally injury prone as well? Would you slot him into that 10 to 13 range in total points?
I would still stick with QB 8 to 10. If he plays 14 to 16 games, I think he can reach that mark. He was QB 16 in only 14 games last year, so I might be a little too high on him, but I still think he can be a low-end QB 1 this year.
Now, Josh, you are notably lower on Tyrod than Sal and I are in our rankings. You have him ranked 18th amongst quarterbacks.
Josh is a Tyrod hater in our group.
Yeah, where do you see him finishing the season?
I'm the traitor in the midst. If I'm just for the answering the question, I would say that in points per game, I expect he'll be in like right around the top 12. I think that he'll do well when he plays generally. So I would say he's probably 12, 13 at the end of the year. But for total points, I think I would be saying 15 to 18 to 20. Like I am pessimistic for a lot of reasons, but I would say 18, 19, kind of where I have him ranked is what I would expect he finishes for total points.
And that's about what he did last year in total points under our, you know, normal scoring settings, not Scott Fishbowl settings. He was the QB 17 in total points. In points per game, he was QB 13. And I mean, that does factor in a lot of, you know, those one of weeks like from Geno Smith, So he was probably closer to, like, of the quarterbacks who played a lot of games, he was probably closer to the QB 10 in points per game. Or Sal, did you say he was QB 8?
Yeah, if you use the data from fantasydata.com, he was QB 8 in points per game and QB 16 in total points.
Yeah, so I'm going to fall somewhere in the middle. I probably have him around maybe QB 10, QB 11 in points per game. And like you guys, I have him a little bit lower in total points, if only because I think that he is a bit of an injury risk. I think all running quarterbacks are a little bit more of an injury risk. So I'd probably put him as like QB 14, QB 15 in total points. But it sounds like the way we feel about him lines up with our rankings on the site, and that makes sense.
And you threw it out there. I'll just make it. I'll emphasize the same point you made, that in the Scott Fishbowl, this is all completely different. I have a much more optimistic view of him there. So we're just talking purely standard leagues when we're guessing these finishes.
So let's talk about that, Josh. How much higher would you rank him for the Scott Fishbowl in your QB ranks?
A whole lot higher. Those rushes make such a huge difference. Just last year, he was the 10th best player out of all NFL players in points per game in this format.
Wow.
And it's just insane. I mean, he did very, very well, even missing two games. So it's not – even in total points, he did well. But getting – I mean, like Scott Fish said just here a few minutes ago, that's an extra 25 points over the course of the season if he gets 100 rushes. And so I do think that helps a lot, both with floor and upside, because you know he has multiple ways to get you points in this format.
Yeah, very cool. Now, one of the things I worry about with Tyrod, and I wanted to talk to you guys a little bit about this, is kind of the uncertainty around Sammy Watkins' health and the fact that his outlook is a little shaky. How much does that make you worry about Tyrod? I bumped him down in my rankings a couple spots because of this, and not just because Watkins might be hurt. It's that the receivers that would have to, you know, fill in for him if he does miss time are pretty middling, pretty mediocre. Relative to a lot of other receiving cores. What do you guys think about the outlook of Sammy Watkins?
Well, right now you mentioned it's shaky, it's uncertain, because he doesn't even really know when he'll be back. I was looking at the latest news on him at RotoWorld, and the last blurb was from June 26th, you know, where he said, "Hopefully I'll be back for the start of training camp. If not, then cool, get ready for the first game." And he also said he had run in like 3 to 4 weeks, but he saw on track for week one. Like, none of that screams, "I'll be ready to play week one." It's just basically like, "I hope I'll be ready to play week one. If not, no big deal. I'll be on the field when I'm ready." So that does play a little bit of an impact when you're thinking about drafting Tyrod Taylor. I mean, for the most part, I'm not going to let Sammy Watkins know current status cloud where or when I'll draft Tyrod Taylor, because I still feel like the rushing quarterbacks do have a little bit of a, you know, baked-in advantage over other quarterbacks. But I am a little bit worried after looking up the stats when Watkins did play last year. So this is the stats I use are from fantasydata.com. Every website's going to be different. But, you know, Tyrod had 7 top 10 weekly finishes last year. And of those 7, Watkins was heavily involved in 5 of them. 4 of them were in the back end of the season, where Watkins was the most healthiest he's been. And no, 2 were at the beginning of the year. Only 1 really was one when he wasn't heavily involved, where Tyrod still finished as a top 10. So I'll kind of focus on the back half, where Tyrod had 4 top 10 finishes from week 12 to week 17. And Sammy Watkins had target games. He had at least 10 targets in 3 of those games. So that you can tell that, you know, Tyrod really trusts Sammy Watkins, which makes sense because he's the best pass catcher in that offense. So it kind of makes you think just what that offense could look like this year without Watkins, and just with the way the rest of the offense looks, especially now that, you know, Chris Hogan's left, and it's basically Greg Salison, Robert Woods as the other top receivers in that offense. So it's something you have to keep in mind when you're drafting Taylor is, you know, will Watkins be healthy all year long? We've kind of seen his career so far in the NFL that, you know, doesn't tend to be the case.
Yeah, does this weigh – what do you think of the receiver's impact on Tyrod, Josh? Is that part of why you have him ranked as low as you do?
Yeah, I think the concern about his weapons is definitely on the list of concerns that I have. for all the reasons that Sal mentioned. I mean, Watkins is very, very good, but health is a concern. And then if he is injured or taken away by a defensive game plan, do they have enough weapons that they will really lean on them? Both can they and will they? I mean, Rex Ryan really likes to run the ball and will run the ball a lot. And if he has weak offensive weapons, particularly if Watkins is out, I could see them saying, look, we're just going to run it 40 times this week, 45 times.
The one thing I like about that is that they do have the running backs to make that work in terms of, you know, their offense as a whole. Now, in terms of how that relates to Tyrod, you're right. There's risk there. That's an opportunity or a chance that, you know, in those types of games, he's just not going to have much to do. And one thing that does give me a little bit of hope, though, and we touched on this in an article, Josh, that you put together a while back about how most of the people at 2QBs like Tyrod a lot this year. One thing I noticed, and I mentioned this in that piece, is that he actually got better in the second half of games generally. And I know that that's kind of an arbitrary thing to talk about, but it does show me that the Buffalo Bills seem like a team that is pretty good at making adjustments and ensuring that Tyrod can be effective. And I don't know how much of that is going to go away in year two, like how much more opposing defenses will be able to game plan against him and the things he can do. But I do have hope that tied to the fact that he has that rushing floor does mean that he's a pretty safe quarterback to draft with or without Watkins. Now, I definitely want Watkins there if I'm drafting Tyrod. And if we find out that, you know, Watkins is going to miss six games or go on the PUP list or something, then, yeah, Tyrod's going to fall down my rankings like a rock. But for now, I'm assuming that Watkins is going to be ready for week one, you know, as all these reports are saying. If that's the case, then I think that Tyrod is still worthy of, you know, a top 12, top 15 quarterback pick.
Yeah, Watkins was pretty much from week 9 on to the end of the season. Watkins was a big part of that offense. And if you look at the game-by-game log for Tyrod, he had at least 4 rushing attempts in each of those games. And from week 13 on, he had 7, 8, 9, 14, 10 attempts. I mean, no, that is a nice floor to have with your fantasy quarterback.
Right. I think that's 100% true. I don't mean to disagree with you, Sal. I think you just have to have that because he doesn't have the pass volume. He had 0 games over 300 pass yards. He had 5 of his 14 games where he threw 21 or fewer passes. And so, yeah, I think you're right that he showed, especially the back half of the season, a huge floor from his rushing. But if for any reason injury or game plan that goes away, I worry that will he have the pass volume to be as reliable as a top 10, top 12 ranking might suggest.
No, I agree with you there. If you take away his rushing prowess, you're looking at like basically like a QB2 instead of a QB1. And if you want to be scared of what that could look like in the second half of the season, his week 11 game, he had 4 rushing attempts for 1 yard. And it was the only game from week 9 to week 17 where he scored less than 10 fantasy points. I mean, 9.42 fantasy points from your QB2 isn't the worst, but you still want to kind of hit that 15-point range.
Yeah, so one comparison I've been finding myself making a lot in this preseason is comparing Tyrod to Marcus Mariota, if only because I feel like their situations are somewhat similar, and the way they play and the way they produce fantasy points is somewhat similar. How do you guys compare the two? I can look at the rankings and see that, you know, Josh, you have Mariota a few spots higher than Tyrod, and Sal, let's see, how's the split for you? You have them only 2 spots apart, so that actually lines up with what I've been saying, that the fact that they do kind of have similar games. But Josh, I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about what differences you see there and why you do have them separated in your ranks a little bit more than, say, Sal does.
I think that one of the things we haven't touched on very much is that I'm concerned that the Bills haven't committed to Tyrod beyond this year. And certainly I don't think that them drafting Cardale Jones is a sign that they're trying to move on this year. But it does make me at least hesitate what'll happen if they get off to a 1-4 start. What if they're 2-6? What if they're 2-8? if that happens, am I sure that they're going to stick with Tyrod, or will they say, we don't have him under contract, we might as well try Cardale? I think that's one issue. And then the other is that I feel like Mariota is the safer play, that he came into the league with a pedigree that says he knows what he's doing and they're going to do everything they can to make him successful. And I think the team's going to do that, versus Tyrod, who's in a Ryan offense where I think if he's struggling and he stays on the field, Ryan could say, fine, we're just going to keep handing it off, kind of what I was alluding to before. So I don't think that Tyrod necessarily has to finish worse than Mariota, but I'm just far less certain about what he'll do than I am with Mariota.
Your first point is interesting there. It kind of reminds me of the Colin Kaepernick situation last year, where the Niners weren't going anywhere. He wasn't playing particularly well. And eventually they just said, well, screw it. Let's see what we have in Blaine Gabbert. And I guess, yeah, you have to acknowledge that sort of scenario is a possibility with Tyrod Taylor. What do you think about that, Sal?
All right, it's always something you have to keep in the back of your mind, just because we know Rex Ryan wants to win. Like, I don't think it matters to him if it's going to be winning with Tyrod Taylor or if it's going to be winning with E.J. Manuel, seeing how he had to deal with the Jets quarterback situation before he came to Buffalo. So, yeah, it makes sense to wonder, you know, if Tyrod does, you know, falter during the season or the Bills are losing. Could they go to Cardale or could they go to E.J. Manuel? I mean, we saw E.J. play last year when Tyrod was down, and he had no – it wasn't the worst thing from a fantasy perspective is to know Manuel was able to perform. And was it to the London game where he finishes a QB1 for the week, I believe? So, yeah, like to Josh's point, I understand the concern. I think maybe for the part where it comes to my draft mentality is I will – take on a little bit more risk for that reward. But at the same time, I also see Marcus Mariota as someone who could finish as a QB1 this year because he's kind of in the same situation. He's a rushing quarterback. He can get you those rushing stats if they let him run. But he might even have better overall weapons to throw to compared to Tyrod. It just, like, the Tennessee Titans, are they committed to, you know, letting Marcus Mariota be the offense? So we kind of saw last year it wasn't the case, and they've talked this year about exotic smash mouth football, whatever that is supposed to mean. But I feel like Marcus Mariota, eventually they'll see, like, he's the guy they should game plan around, and he's their offense. But that, like, that's part of my concern when it comes to Marcus Mariota is the offense season. You know, for Josh, he's kind of worried, you know, the Bills haven't committed to Tyrod Taylor. And if we're talking dynasty leagues, I'd probably have, you know, that concern would matter more to me. But for redraft, I look at it as a one-year window where this is the situation right now, and this is how it's going to impact my drafting.
So do you guys have any other thoughts on Tyrod here before we move on?
I don't think so.
You know, no, they can check out our roundtable, like, where we do think he's better than everybody else.
Yeah, definitely check out that article. I'll put a link in the show notes so you can check that out. And I feel like I say that every episode, like, hey, I'm going to link to this in the show notes, and then I never do. But maybe this time will be different. You'll have to click on the show notes themselves to find out. Let's move on to some Twitter questions. We didn't actually solicit for these necessarily on this episode because we knew we were going to have Scott on. We knew we had a lot to get to regarding the Scott Fish Bowl. But we have some kind of some questions lying around. One of them is one that we read last week on the podcast from Ben Gretsch. And he asked, what is your advice for how to handle the quarterback superflex in the Scott Fish Bowl? What type of premium should be put on the position? I feel like we've covered this a little bit, but do either of you want to dive in a little deeper? What do you say, Sal?
No, I think we hit on it earlier. You kind of want that super flex position to be filled by a quarterback because they tend to score more points than the other positions. How much of a premium? That kind of depends on your roster construction. If you want to, you know, spend two early picks, then you're looking at your first two rounds. But because of that 0.25 carry, maybe you want to look at quarterbacks that, you know, have that rushing capability baked into them later on. And you guys are probably going to say, of course you're going to say that, Sal, but no, Alex Smith was fourth in quarterback rushing attempts last year with 84. And right now I believe he's going off as the QB22 or QB23 in Scott Fishbowl ADP. So if you don't want to spend too much of a premium, you can look at those running backs later on in the mid rounds or late rounds that, you know, have that rushing floor already baked into their ADP.
How about you, Josh? You got any thoughts on this?
Yeah, I think that people are generally sleeping on quarterbacks coming into this draft. I threw out some of the numbers and the comparisons to wide receivers, and I think one of the stat changes that is being overlooked is the way that tight end premium came in, is that last year you got one full point per PPR for anyone, and now it's half. So tight ends still get 1 point, but wide receivers and running backs only get half a point PPR. So what it did is last year people saw wide receivers and pass-catching running backs do really well. This year, all of their catches are worth half as much, and I think that really elevated quarterbacks who were unchanged more than most people are thinking.
That's a great point. I hadn't really considered that. Our next question comes from @JawZeris on Twitter, and his question is interesting. He says he wants us to discuss league structure, the pros and cons of using a kicker position, and why we use certain settings as defaults. So I've written about this, and I recently did on the rankings post that I put up for 2016 redraft rankings at 2QBs. And I'm actually for a kicker position in fantasy and a defense position. I understand the arguments behind getting rid of them, but I am always in for using positions that encourage my opponents to make mistakes in the draft. I feel like that there's a legitimate advantage you can gain in the draft by understanding the true value of kickers and of defenses, and that is that they have no value. So if you let other people draft those, you know, in any round but the last round, then that's only going to make your team better. Now, in season, yes, kickers and defenses can attribute to more variance, which, you know, does, you know, hurt the stronger players. But I feel like I can battle through that, and I'm also a good enough judge of how to deploy those two positions overall, like on a week-to-week basis. Maybe not every week, but most weeks I feel like I'll be fine there. I think that those positions are still okay to include in fantasy, and I don't necessarily understand the advocacy to make them go away. How do you guys feel about those silly one-of positions?
Well, I can understand wanting to get rid of them because it's just, you know, less research you have to do, because a lot of people just draft one defense and draft one kicker they think is elite based on last year's scoring and just leave them in their starting lineup for the whole season. But one reason why you might want to keep kicker or keep defense is if you are someone that heavily invests in research in the offseason and in the in-season you're a very active owner, you can look at kicker scoring, defense scoring, just stream the position all year and kind of use that to your advantage when the rest of your league just looks at the defense that scored the most points last week and they're like, okay, I'll just start this person and as my kicker, this person is my defense, and not put any thought into the matchups and what – no, like how we kind of put into the thought for tight end and quarterback streaming. So that's one advantage where I would keep kicker and defense, but I'm all for getting rid of them just because it's less research you have to do in the off season.
Yeah, TJ Hernandez over at 444 had a good article arguing to keep the kicker position and saying that it gives smart owners a competitive advantage because they're never going to take a kicker early, but one or two teams in your league will, and they're just hurting themselves that way. It was an interesting read. I'm personally all for getting rid of the kicker position, but after a decade of trying in my home league, I've kind of given up because everyone just says it's tradition, and so it stays.
Yeah, I can understand wanting to simplify the game by making those positions go away because they are a little more irrelevant than, you know, quarterback, wide receiver, running back, tight end. But yeah, I don't know. I'm not advocating for it on the tradition tip alone. It does have a lot to do with that notion that TJ put out there, that I do believe you have an advantage if you're smart about how you approach the kicker position relative to the rest of your league. Now, to his second part, when he talks about default settings, I'm not exactly sure what he wants us to talk about specifically, but I'm just curious as to what your guys' default settings are. If you're making a league, where do you set the value for common things like passing touchdowns tends to vary from league to league, receptions? Do you like giving points for carries and things like that? What defaults do you like to see?
I don't play in points per carry leagues other than the Scott Fishbowl and other leagues run by Scott. But I really have enjoyed that. I enjoy that it makes the running backs very interesting when they haven't been nearly as much in the last couple of years. for me, I feel like half point PPR is the way to go. I like that a lot because it seems to strike a good balance that catches aren't these crazy, insane, valuable things where you have very bad players that are catching six passes becoming viable. Half point gives them some value but doesn't blow it out of proportion. So that to me is one of the ones I really like.
Yeah, I mean, I pretty much just stick with tradition. I'm not as creative as Scott when it comes to creating leagues. I don't run any leagues as commissioner, so I only kind of know the one thing, which is 12 teams, 0.5 PPR, 6 points for all touchdowns. Like, those are my defaults, and then I've just stuck with them because, like you mentioned earlier, it's tradition, and we just haven't changed it.
Yeah, I tend to not really care about value of passing touchdowns, although it does make a difference, and we'll get to that shortly. In terms of PPR, I'm with you guys. I think half point is the way to go. I could even see, you know, like a number like 0.2 or 0.3. I think anything more than a half a point for a reception is excessive, because then those like bubble screens that don't go anywhere at the line of scrimmage end up being worth, you know, the same as a 5-yard run, and that's just kind of absurd in the first place. I understand why we do it, but yeah, I tend to think that like full PPR, where like if you catch one of those bubble screens or even like catch a pass for a loss, you're still getting a lot of points for that relative to like a running back. And that just feels wrong to me. At Jazaris did follow up and he did ask a specific question about 4 points per passing touchdown versus 6 points. Again, I don't think I have a preference between them. In fact, if anything, I like to just, I'll do something silly and I'll fall in the middle and say I like 5 points per passing touchdown, just so you don't have to have these weird arguments. But it does affect how the quarterback position is valued within the quarterback ranks. Like in a 4 point per touchdown league, the running guys go up in value. I've done some analysis for this in the past at the Fake Football, and I'll try to remember to put those links in the show notes as well. But there are some other weird instances where, you know, certain quarterbacks will have more value if the passing touchdowns are only worth 6, or I mean only worth 4 versus 6. Do you guys have any thoughts on 6 versus 4 for passing touchdowns?
I think most people kind of just tend to say the same thing. You know, if you're playing a 4 point per passing touchdown league, rushing quarterbacks get a little bit of a bonus because their rushing touchdowns are worth 6. Then if you play in a league where it's 6 points for passing touchdowns, the quarterbacks are going to be even worth more just because you're just adding an extra 2 points per passing touchdowns. Look at Cam Newton, for instance. Last year he was QB1 with 389 points, and he passed for 35 touchdowns. All of a sudden, if you add in an extra 2 points per touchdown, you're looking at going from 389 to 460 at the quarterback position. And it does have a bit of a skew at the end of season when you're looking at total points.
I think particularly I think that's right, but then it's even more emphasized in leagues that are few, but like the Scott Fish Bowl, where your playoff berth can be based on total points there, that becomes even more important to think about.
Yeah, that's a good point. The only other thing I'd bring up there, and this is one of those things I noticed, is that there are some, you know, like pocket passers, non-rushing passers who will gain value when passing touchdowns are worth less. And those tend to be the guys who get their points more from yardage than from TDs. And in my experience, that tends to happen with good to decent quarterbacks on teams with bad defenses. So like Matt Stafford was a great example of that for years, where, you know, he just had to pass a lot because the Lions were always behind. And then that kind of went away for like a year and a half. And then it started to come back again at the end of last year. And he's a guy you can target in those 4 points per passing touchdown leagues that, you know, maybe because the defense isn't quite good or because the offense is a little more up tempo all the time, those guys will score more points via yardage and their value goes up because of that relative to leagues where passing touchdowns are worth more. That's it for the Twitter questions. Sal, you don't come on the pod that often, so I want to give you a little bit of a window here to talk about anything else that's been on your mind.
I just want to thank the 2 quarterback community for kind of reinforcing the idea why we started 2 QBs in the first place, which is we saw that 2 quarterback superflex weren't getting as much coverage as they should, and it's still a niche format, but it's a niche format that's getting more traction,
And just by the amount of articles we've been able to push out, the amount of support we've been getting from Twitter, people listening to the podcast. So basically, I just want to say thank you to everybody for supporting the website, for supporting the podcast, and just helping us chug along with this 2QB movement.
How about you, Josh? Any parting thoughts before we sign off for the day?
No, I think it's been good. We've said it before, but the only thing I'll add is that we're going weekly now, so you can expect to be hearing from us every week.
Yep, and we got a great guest lined up for next week as well, and the week after that, so definitely tune in to the upcoming episodes. We really think you're going to like what we have going on. If you have not subscribed to the podcast, we'd appreciate it if you did that. You can do that on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play. I know that they now have podcasts on Spotify. I'm going to try to get us up on there ASAP. We're still doing Twitter polls. No, we're not. But we have an idea for some new Twitter polls. And keep an eye out for that. Follow us on Twitter at 2QBs. That's TWOQBS. We're on Instagram and Facebook as well if you want to search us up there. And, of course, if you have some longer form questions, you can always send those to 2QBs@gmail.com. The last thing I want to mention here is that, Josh, you're setting up a new round of mock drafts this weekend. Is that correct?
That's right. The invites will go out this weekend. We're going to kick off the drafts Monday, and we are going to run as many as possible, as often as possible. Now that we're getting closer to draft season, the more reliable ADP we can pump out from these things, the more useful it's going to be for you guys. So hit us up on Twitter, send us an email if you are interested in joining. These have, I said it before, but they have 8-hour pick timers, so that even with busy real life jobs, family, whatever, school, whatever it may be, you can still join and have your time to pick during the day.
Yeah, and the My Fantasy League setup lets you kind of stay in tune with the draft in a very casual way with those pick timers, where you can set it up to give yourself a text message when it's your turn to pick. And then after that happens, you still have 8 hours to make your picks. So it's really easy to get involved and become a part of this ADP that we're creating. And you know, the more diverse population we can pull from in the drafts, the better data we're going to get, just like Josh said. So with that, definitely get into a mock if you can. Otherwise, be sure to keep coming to 2QBs.com, checking out all the awesome stuff we got going. We're going to keep it going all through the off season. Weekly podcasts are now a thing. So I want to thank you all for your support. Very much appreciated. And we'll catch you next time on the 2QB Experience. Adios.